Hey guys, welcome to Content Candy's new show. It's kind of an old show. It's Cinema Bias with myself, Video Drew, and Alex Mack. Please enjoy. Check us out wherever you can find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, what have you. Like and rate and leave a review. That's like a thing you can do on podcasts. And make sure to also check out patreon.com/VideoDrew to find out ways that you can support this channel, which is growing. Okay, end of thing. I always love doing this on the top of the show, just making my face. Hey, Alex.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Yes. Welcome indeed to a movie. We're going to cover a movie. I don't think anyone actually knows about it. Like, is it even?
No, guys, welcome to the Five Corners episode of Cinema Bias. We're so excited to have you here, but also you're so excited to talk about the movie Five Corners, which I'm sure is one of your top 10 films of all time, starring Jodie Foster, John Turturro, but the other guy,
Tim Robbins,
and by our favorite ever of all time screenwriter, John Patrick Shanley.
Alex? Slash director.
But mostly, he's one of my favorite screenwriters. But before we get into that, we've got a theme. Let's listen to it now. This episode, what's the best Pokemon and why is it Guzzlord?
I already told you it's the best Pokemon of all time. It's Nidoqueen because
Nidoqueen.
She's awesome. She's literally queen. I mean,
Nidoqueen's really good. There's a, I think one of the Jigglypuffs or whatever in one of the earlier later sets, so like Neo Destiny or something, his power is group therapy. And I was like, love that for you. I love that for you.
It's kind of perfect. Love that. Considering. Really
I
is.
Need some group therapy after seeing today's episode, but real quick, Cinema Bias, guys, if you haven't been here before, it's a show where me and Alex sort of push each other out of our respective comfort zones when it comes to movies and make each other kind of watch stuff that we wouldn't normally watch. Like, for instance, I don't watch a lot of weepy melodramas. I don't like watching things that make me cry or biodocs or things that are not just horror movies. And Alex here doesn't like, what do you not like, Alex? What's outside your comfort zone, rather?
Drew got me into horror movies. Now I like horror movies so much more than I thought. I'm not really big into dramas because I don't like crying. And I don't like it when families fight because I don't want to get depressed.
Oh, you don't like family melody. You don't like the kitchen sink weepies as they used to call
Oh,
them.
I hate that. What was it?
Orange August, Osage County.
Oh, August. That one. I'm like, fuck this movie. Oh,
yeah.
Like, I hate everyone in that movie.
That movie made me like viscerally angry, especially because Tracy Letts, who's the playwright of that movie and is very famous, like an actor. Mm-hmm. I was like, what are you doing, Tracy? Like, what are you doing, like, focusing your attention on this, like, boring-ass white family with their melodrama? Like, I even hate the term melodrama, because it seems like a contradiction of sorts. It's like, here's some drama, but it's instinctually just, like, not even a big deal. It's melodrama. It's, like, only important to the people who it's going on to. Like, it's not about the world. It's not about the high stakes of, like, are you saving the planet? Or are you, like, saving the government? Are you saving the president? By definition, melodrama is about the shit that goes on under your roof that only you would care about.
And it's also like I used to live in Oklahoma. I get it.
Yeah.
It's a very boring, not fun place. So there was actually some parts where I was like, yep, that's Oklahoma, or at least feels like it. So that's where that action adventure is I not think about it. I have seen very little sports movies. Sports movies are hard.
I've gotten into sports movies because of Schmodown, and I feel like that's helped me with sports movies. But like the stakes in sports movies are kind of like the stakes in any music bio doc, where you're like, okay, like at this point it's been satirized so much that you can like tell where the beats are coming, and it's not that inherently interesting.
Like Chariots of Fire. I'm like, no.
That's kind of a sports movie. Yeah, that is a sports movie.
No, it is 100% a sports movie.
Yeah, I was thinking of Spartacus. Never mind.
Trying to outrace each other.
Yes. Yeah, but like you don't think of it as the other kind. Look at this one, though. This is not a sports movie or a melodrama, I would say. This is like a straight up crime drama. Or just like, this is just a straight up drama.
It's definitely van life kind of city drama, for sure.
It's like if Scorsese was like a little less interested in being like an edgelord, he would come up with this movie.
Like, oh my gosh, now that you say that's kind of, what?
It's like if Scorsese decided to focus the movie on anyone other than Travis Bickle, you would have this film. It's like specifically like about what the world looks like if you are like friends in like the bigger friend group of Travis Bickle, being like, that guy's weird.
Or, yeah, like, just legitimate gangsters or anything.
Yeah. I mean, like, I feel like the John Turturro movie in this film is specifically a response to, like, the Mean Streets, like, Harvey Keitel and De Niro in Mean Streets.
Jodie Foster. Like,
yeah.
Taxi Driver. Yeah.
It's not Jodie Foster. Of course it's, like, a reference to Taxi Driver.
There you go. See? Making connections all the time. Yeah, it's now that you say that, it's like really hard to ignore. I never really made that connection, but it's definitely there. But not only that, I feel like there's a lot of underlying themes. There's a lot of, I don't want to say darkness in this movie.
There's a lot of darkness. Less so than I thought there was going to be. I thought it was going to be super dark because of the thesis of it, or like the description of it made it sound, I think, a lot darker than it actually turned out to be. Like it turned out to be about things other than like rape and like a stalking. I thought it was gonna be like Cape Fear, and it wasn't that much. Another De Niro movie. It wasn't that much like Cape Fear. Mm-hmm. It had a Cape Fear subplot, but it wasn't about Cape Fear.
Yeah, it's and I also think that a lot of that really comes through because of the strong performances. But we're gonna dive into like each and every one of them in particular, because this is just weird. I feel like this is a very weird movie. It's a hard movie to watch. It's not an enjoyable movie to watch either. Like I don't think I'll ever be excited to watch this again. Honestly,
it'd be weird if you were. It'd be weird if you like I saw a movie recently, Alex, called Caveat, that was on Shudder, and I tweeted about it because I think it might be the scariest movie I've ever seen in my life. Like it was,
I've heard that,
terrifying. And, like, it got retweeted by Shudder. It became, like, something that has, like, 500 likes. It's, like, my most liked tweet in forever. It's got retweeted. I started talking to the director. And, like, that movie I watched 3 times in, like, 2 days. Like, it's a really short film, and I just rewatched it. I watched it, and I was, like, I have to watch this again. And I was, like, I have to go show Eric. And then I was, like, I have to go show a bunch of other people. And it's, like, that kind of experience to me, even though it's a pretty dour movie with really scary, upsetting imagery. Like, I could just rewatch. This movie, I feel like, I've seen it, I've clocked it, I know who's in it, so in case I ever spin Jodie Foster, I'll have this movie on the docket. But, like, I don't think, like, I need to tell him. I mean, I would like to probably bring it up as a little trivia fact about, like, look, this thing John Turturro did. Or, like, if I was in the movie old, I'd be like, what movie has John Turturro and Tim Robbins? And I'd be able to say this one is. But, like, it's really hard. It's really hard to, like, try to recommend this.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's also, oh, thank you, Ben. It's also, John Turturro is one of those character actors that I absolutely adore. He's so weird and funny. He's great in any kind of dramedy. I mean, he licks a fucking bowling ball in Big Lebowski. I hate that movie, but I love him in that movie.
He's Big Lebowski? I feel like I didn't know that about you, but it's hilarious.
It's like, that movie frustrates me so much. I can't get over it. I'm like annoyed and angry at everyone at the same time. I'm like, who the fuck cares about this rug? Who will tie his room together? I'm like, I don't care.
Yeah. You're like, this is the melodrama of the Coen brothers in your mind.
Like, it's so weird. Anyway, but yeah, John Turturro, he is such a
weird looking motherfucker.
His character is almost Shakespearean. I don't know if it's just because of his performance in particular, but I especially comparison to a lot of the other individual performances. Like we see Tim Robbins' character.
I was saying in this movie, I thought you were still talking about Lebowski, and I was like, I mean, you don't fuck with Jesus, a great line, but I'm not sure if he elevates it to like the bar.
Well, they all go through some kind of transformation, obviously, and some, but him in particular, it comes full circle. He's self-realized. He is looking,
Oh,
he's
which is
not
very much, it's like the
looking.
outsiders, like his
Yeah.
journey in this is very much like the journey of like the outsiders or again Mean Streets or that one with that John Cassavetes did with Peter Falk and Cassavetes were their best friends, where it's sort of like that, you know, that realization of like I fucked up, but you were here for me, you know, that best friend bond or like that not best friend, but like that sort of two guy bond that can sometimes happen. It reminded me a lot, that last scene reminded me a lot of The Outsider, but let's back up a minute. What was your thoughts about this movie just based on its description? And I can read it to you again if you need to hear it. Let me do that real quick. The description of The Five Corners, which by the way is a reference to a looks like a grocery store bodega in Harlem, I believe, which is where the movie takes place.
Makes sense.
And by the way, this is a very New York movie, like Moonstruck. This is like a very New York movie. It's like a slice of life in New York. It does show that he's
Brooklyn.
there's like no Harlem, which is not is it Brooklyn? I thought it was Harlem.
I
Let's
thought I could
see.
have sworn you said Brooklyn, but
It's in the Bronx. Sorry, we were both wrong. It's the
Bronx.
Bronx.
I remember
It's
starting
the
with the
Bronx.
B. My bad. Yeah.
It's a different borough altogether. The Bronx, which is closer to Harlem, but still not Brooklyn. It's just because no one's in the Bronx. Like Chaz Palahniuk is in the Bronx, and that's it. In the Bronx in 1964, it takes place over 48 hours, by the way, in case anyone was wondering. A high school teacher is shot in the back of the head with an arrow and is killed. Wait, what? I think I missed that part. A man offers to give two young ladies a ride. There's all
Arresting.
the stuff that goes on. But basically, there's this guy, Hines, who's just been released from prison after serving a thing for attempted rape of Jodie Foster. And he's returned to his neighborhood to resume a relationship with his crazy mom and to try to like rekindle the romance with Jodie Foster. And then there's this other guy, Tim Robbins, who's protected Jodie Foster during the initial rape attempt, but now he's like adopted this like non he's adopted this like pacifist, like non-violent approach towards everything after his dad was killed in the line of duty.
As a
He
cop.
decided to go down and like help black activists in the South, but they don't want him there because they're like, you're a white guy, like get out of our fucking way. And he's like, and he like really loves Dr. Martin Luther King. And then there's like all these other people that are just kind of like hanging around, have their own stories. There's like these two kids that like keep hooking up, and they've got their own love story going on, but they don't want to like the guy's not that into her because she does pills and like runs around, and she gets sold at one point, I think, for some money, and he sells her
$5.
$5, and she's like, I'm worth at least 20 or something. It is, but he's not a pimp. It's just weird.
He's
But
just like,
then.
hey, I just want these girls out of my car.
Yeah, he just wants the
Literally.
girls out of the car, and he sells her for $5.
They're being too noisy. They're
Yeah,
high.
weirdly, that is put up as one of the better relationships we see in this film. Like the more healthy relationships that are in this film is the guy who sells his girlfriend for five
Just so
dollars.
much. Yeah, this movie has like a lot of I know this movie is supposed to be based on personal experiences from
Wait,
John
really? Because I didn't
Patrick
even get to the
Fleming's.
crazy shit yet.
Well, it's like he said that it's based off personal experiences or of stuff that he heard growing up living in that neighborhood. Not that neighborhood in particular, but a neighborhood like that, living in New York City in the 50s. And watching that, I can definitely see that completely makes sense. It definitely feels very much like a slice of life, which I think it's like really great at. However, this movie makes me so uncomfortable. But
It also is
it's
kind of
also
like reminiscent of
that's
Summer of
one of the
Sam because, like, there's also, by the way, in the backdrop, just a guy going around shooting people with arrows in the back of the head. Because there's a
Yeah,
teacher in the beginning, and then at the end, Hines is shot with an arrow in the back of the head. And we don't know who that is. It's just
it's never
mysterious.
really resolved. And
No, just someone's
like,
going around shooting people in the
yeah.
back of the head with arrows. By the way, I didn't even get the part with the penguins. This is like the most upsetting part of the movie.
Oh my gosh, I literally almost cried. I was like,
I freaked out. So, like, John Turturro. So, Jodie Foster does a dumb thing in this movie. I'm just gonna be straight with you. I know it was the 50s. I know women had to adhere to different standards of how polite they were. But this dude tried to rape her, and then he calls her out of prison and is like, "You need to meet me downtown, near the park, like near the fountain." And she's like, "In the middle of the night?" And he's like, "Yep." And she's like, "I don't think I should." And he's like, "Yeah, you should." And she's like, "Okay, I will."
Well,
And like,
she does it because I don't know what I'm gonna do. I might like, hurt someone.
Fucking cares.
I might hurt someone, or I might hurt myself.
Yeah, and I know. But like, honestly, first of all, tell somebody where you're going. Like, she tries to call Tim Robbins, but his mom doesn't tell him that she called because she's just like, you keep putting yourself in danger. Stop doing that. You're trying to get yourself killed. You're like your dad. Also, they have a dog named Buddha. That's really cute. That was really cute. I kept wondering, like, what do you mean take the Buddha out? And I was like, oh, it's the name of the dog. So John Turrell's like, hey, I got you a gift. And she's like, what is it? And he's like, turn around. And you're like, this is a bad idea, Jodie Foster. I know you've had some bad ideas in movies in the past, but this one's maybe the worst. And so she turns around and there's nothing there. And she's like, where is it? And he's like, look in the fountain. And then there's like two penguins. He got her penguins. He broke into a zoo and got her penguins. And she's like, oh. And then she's like, okay, time to bring them back in the zoo. And he's like, well, no, they're a gift. Like, they're your penguins. And she's like, yeah, you can't, like, keep penguins. They need, like, special food and habitat and stuff. And he's like, are you saying you don't like the gift?
But I got them for you.
Yeah, he's like, I got them for you. You don't like the gift? And she's like, no. And he's like, what, you want to bring it back? And she's like, yeah, I want the penguins to go back. And he's like, okay. And he just takes one and he just beats it to death. He just beats the penguin to death. Like a little penguin, baby penguin, just beats a baby penguin to death right in front of her. And then he's like, don't worry, I got the other one and you'll accept it, right? Like, you'll like this one. And she's like, and she tries to run away with the penguin. Then she had this boyfriend I forgot to mention. He's like another dude who's just hanging out. She's got this boyfriend. He tries to rescue her. Or they broke up, but you know, for all intents and purposes, that's who like John Turrell threatens.
Okay, yeah, she dumps him like before the events of the film, she dumps him. And so their introduction in the movie is them literally fighting because at that point she already dumped him and he's trying to get her back. And he's like, you're not breaking up with me. It's like, you totally just broke up with me just for show, just so you can do this and this because you're trying to.
He accuses her of like aggressive. Trying to like get with John Turturro, like she wants to get with her rapist, like she's, and I think she's trying to protect him, but I think his view on it is that she's trying to dump him for Turturro, which is like a really
no and she because no it's because he thinks that she's trying, she mentions that she has mentioned several times throughout the movie, you can't protect me, and yeah. She thinks Tim Robbins,
right. She thinks Tim Robbins.
She's like, he can protect me. She goes over to his house.
Well, he protected her once before from being raped by this guy who she's about to go and meet in Central Park in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, God, she's a girl.
Job to her, absolutely not.
I mean, girl, you got to know what you're getting into right there. He just got out of prison from like rape, like of you, attempted, but still. Mm-hmm. What could he possibly do that like you don't think could be done worse if you were there physically? I don't know. That was kind of hard to swallow and hard to watch when you're just like, oh, that's not going to end well. Like, there's no scenario. Maybe in a Scorsese film would that end in a good scenario where he like saves her from being raped by an even worse person. But like, no, he's just going to kill a baby penguin right in front of her face and then like take her to a roof. And oh yeah, push his mom out of a window.
That after having hard. This confrontation, being like, see me, just see me, please.
Like anyway, you're not awake.
That's actually a really great scene.
Jake is asking why you're wearing a Matrix trench coat. Some questions just don't have answers, Jake. What's your shirt say?
I need more space.
Oh, I love that in little space, man. That's so true. God, I need that shirt, honestly. I need a shirt that actually has a buffer so I can literally not be touched while saying I need more space.
Because a lot of times it's a great shirt. I've had it for a few years and I love it. Every time I wear this jacket, because it is a little bit short and it's like I got it like one size up, and it's like a larger one in general. Lucas keeps, every time I wear it, he's like, just reminds me, hey Alex, when are you gonna release your new hip hop and 90s hip hop album?
Nice.
Because then he's like, are you gonna pose for us? Like,
oh yeah, it does kind of look like that. It also kind of looks like, yeah, you're in a backstreet or something.
Yeah, you are my body.
Yeah, you're so pose.
but back to the movie though, in particular though, it's so she mentions several times throughout the movie she's looking for a protector. She's not getting a protector
hero.
She genuinely, she's looking for some kind of actual hero in her mind, because in her mind, she's not enough.
Well, to be, and let's be honest, TBH, she's not. Guys, she's going up against.
If a woman says no, it's not enough, unfortunately.
Well, it's also the 1950s, and it's also like the kind of thing that she's being bred at. But you also see like a comparison with that, with like the other chick who's very like strong and assertive and stands up for herself. It's also just kind of like who Jodie Foster is in this movie, that she's so demure that it's not like she's not canny. She's like smart enough to know that she needs somebody to help her out, and she's kind of like maneuvering her way into trying to be in Tim Robbins' life because he saved her once. So like she's like, he's like imprinted on her or something, like that kind of thing. So she knows who she needs, and she knows who's kind of like not going to be that helpful in the situation, which is like, quite honestly, she was right. Their boyfriend was useless in that situation. Tim Robbins saved the day once again.
Mm-hmm. He did. Yeah. But because of his newfound discovery of pacifism, he like, when at the very beginning of the film, he goes up to him and he's like, I love you. Like, and he's has this like this new philosophy on life.
Yeah, he does like an Albert and Twin Peaks thing where he's like, I have a philosophy of Dr. King and it's all about love, and I love you, dude, who like tried to rape this chick.
And he's like, I just got released in jail and you're telling me this? And he's like, yeah, I love you. Meanwhile, I'm walking this big, beautiful Buddha dog.
Yeah, he's like, oh yeah. Well, it's always easy to tell like a attempted rapist that you love them while carrying a gigantic, like a sheep, horse, husky, and being like, mm-hmm. yeah, that dog's going to come after you. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I do feel like there is some sense in like knowing what your strengths are and knowing what your weaknesses are and delegating. So if your strength is not being physically strong, go find yourself a guy who is. Like, that's fine. But like, don't. But also just be smart about things. So if you know you're not physically strong, don't go out with your attempted rapist at like midnight and meet him at a fountain where no one knows you're going. Don't do that. Mm-hmm. That's common sense, even in the 50s, mm-hmm. I feel like.
Well, she did bring a bat in her defense.
But yeah, in her defense, she brought a bat, I guess.
Oh, look at that.
Look at that big old dog. It's almost like the dog. It's not quite the sheepdog from Serpico, but it kind of reminds me of it. Reminds me, I think in the olden days, people had bigger dogs. Am I crazy? I feel like in the 70s, everyone's dog was, like, gigantic.
I mean, that's. I feel like that's also a thing surrounding, like, dogs in general were also bigger decades ago.
Yeah, I mean, like, historically, dogs were bigger. But I'm just saying, like, in terms of where we are now, I feel like dogs are mostly, like, my dog size. Where are they?
Yeah.
They're so small, I can't even see them.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, I can definitely see that for sure. There's, for a long time, I feel like, my grandparents on both sides would say, like, there's no point in having a dog unless it's, like, this big.
A big chonker dog.
It's, like, a very Ron Swanson thing to say.
I want a dog if it's going to be big enough to protect me, to be my hero. My hero that I'm holding on for till the edge of the night.
Be a hero,
that hero. That's all I can hear now. It's like, she needs a hero to save her from the guy with the penguins. And he's gotta be big, and he's gotta be Robbins, and he's gotta be a pacifist. She needs a hero. So let's talk about how this is called flirting. Well, he went to jail for attempted flirting. So I think it was still enough of a thing, Marcus. He says in the 50s it wasn't called rape, it was called flirting. There was still attempted flirting. I mean, that was still a crime that you could go to jail for. I do want to talk about like Totoro's role in this, and then maybe we can just talk about Pokemon the rest of the time because I don't care. But like Totoro in this is, he puts on such a good performance. I'm not sure, have you ever seen Barton Fink?
No.
Okay, Barton Fink is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's another Coen Brother movie, and it's a movie that knows. Like you were saying about like melodramas, you don't like them I was saying that I don't like them because they're just about small stakes and small potatoes and small, you know, small issues, small dramas, people's personal lives. And, but it's not like I love action adventure, which are a bit big stakes so much either. It's not very particular, but Barton Fink is like the rare movie where it's about somebody's narcissistic, solipsistic attitude about life. Like a character played by John Turturro, who's this playwright, moves to Los Angeles to write for TV. And feels like, or write for Hollywood movies, and feels like his soul has been bankrupt, like he's been artistically compromised, and spends the entire movie sort of like hemming and hawing about his existential dilemma and how he only wants to write theater for the common man, and like what a great like champion of the common man he is. And next door to him lives John, or he's in a hotel, and next door to him is staying like John Goodman, who is a door-to-door salesman, and who is like, oh yeah, I could tell you some stories about the common man. And he's just like, yeah, no, I know you could. And that's the point. And he's like consistently cutting him off. Meanwhile, there's like a murder happening. Like his girlfriend dies in this horrible thing. And he wakes up and she's dead in the bed next to him, like having been horribly murdered. So now he's in the middle of like a murder plot, but he's still just like stuck on how he's like creatively blocked, and he has writer's block and he can't get anything out. And then at the end of the movie, no spoilers, but like it turns out like everything's been happening right around him this whole time, and he just hasn't been paying any attention because he's been so caught up on his own bullshit that he's like not aware. Like he's been just talking and talking and talking so much that he hasn't like listened or looked around and seen like this vast conspiracy going on like surrounding him. And I just think that is the best kind of John Turturro role. Although he can play crazy so good, and he can do all these other things.
That's a very LA movie right there.
It's an LA noir, but it's also just about how people move to LA with all these pretensions of being like, I'm smarter than LA people. LA people are so vapid and mm-hmm. so stupid, and I'm from the East Coast.
I'm so talented. So I know people. Also, John Turturro, he's like, I think he's one of those actors. I feel like he's been in a bazillion things, and I'm sure he has.
Like approximately a bazillion.
It's funny because he has such a, he has like one of those interesting careers and where, faces. Yeah, and faces. I think he's such a great face. He's such an expressive, interesting face.
He's the kind of guy my mom would call very attractive, but my mom does that because she like likes the idea that her taste is really weird. So she's like, oh, he's such a handsome man, but she'll say it as almost like trolling you just so you'd be like, no, he's not handsome. She's like, oh, well, I think he's very handsome. And you'd be mom, you don't think he's handsome. Like, just because you want to bone him doesn't mean he's hot, and you know that objectively.
In particular, it's because I remember like I was watching the Olympics earlier, and they were doing an interview with Michael Phelps, and I was looking, and I was what?
Wait, yeah, did he smoke weed? Why is he still allowed to be around? I thought we kicked off people who were smoking weed.
No, I mean, he was caught smoking weed when he one time in college, but that was like...
No, after the Olympics, was he caught smoking weed?
That was like 12 years ago.
Yeah, but it was after...
It was after the Olympics. Like, he wasn't even, like... training for the Olympics at the time.
Yeah, but we got some other girl out because that's beside the point. Mm-hmm. Michael Phelps is looking. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I was like, it was like the first time in a while I've seen like him up close, and he's like this 6'6", bird of a man, and his face looks really weird. I never really thought about it before, but. Then I was like, yeah, he kind of reminds me of like Benedict Cumberbatch, where I'm like, I don't know why, but I find him attractive.
I was like, Alec, no.
And then I'm like, yeah, he's just such an interesting face to me. And Lucas was like, yeah, he's kind of like Matt Smith. And I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, Matt Smith.
Matt Smith is ugly. And
Lucas said, Matt Smith, he's like, he's a good looking guy, but he looks like Frankenstein.
No, he doesn't. He's not a good looking guy. I agree with Lucas that that he looks like Frankenstein. I do not agree that he's a good looking guy. He is very weird looking, and I don't understand why we're on him. I get that we let him be Doctor Who, but like Doctor Who's supposed to be an alien. I don't get why we allow him to be in other movies and don't just like put him in like a little regulation bin for people who can only play like inbred royal princes.
Because let me tell you, because he is so talented, he played Patrick Bateman in London's West End.
Okay, well that kind of works. I bet that would work because Patrick Bateman's kind of like an American royal. Like that's like if we had a prince, that would be it.
I actually like the idea of him playing Patrick Bateman because the idea of he's in a world of completely conventional, if not boring, aesthetically, people around him. And then he comes out and he's a serial killer and he looks like Frankenstein. And so it's like just like a weird, interesting contrast aesthetically.
He's supposed to be so generic looking that like you could confuse him for any other guy who worked at that firm. I feel like the thing about Matt Smith would be like, oh, that weird dude, the guy with the Frankenstein face? He looks like a posh Frankenstein.
Well, he made it work. I'm into it.
I want to see one. See, like, I do find people like John Turturro, like, I can see their inherent attractiveness. I just know that they're also ugly. Like, I can understand his charisma and his appeal. I think there's something very, like, you know, very not sexual, but like very like vibrant about him, and that it has like a sort of energy that I find attractive. But like, I think we can all just agree here on a base level. Let's talk about reality here. Like, this is gonna make me feel like I'm going crazy. He's a physically unattractive man. Like, he's not unattractive. He's an ugly man. He's got an ugly face. He's also hot.
How dare you?
Oh, he's got a Frankenstein face. Him,
no, like, he's to me, he looks attractive. To me, he looks like middle age attractive. I mean, like,
well, yeah, he grew into it.
He's attractive, like, to me, how Pierce Brosnan is attractive.
Okay, but that's because they're older now, and he grew into his face a little bit. But when he was younger, he was particularly distinctively weird-looking.
You have to remember, the Turturro that I grew up with is middle-aged Turturro.
Not even that middle-aged.
Him as, like, a baby Turturro is completely new to me.
This is him and Barton Fink, and I mean, that's what I think of Turturro. I think of like this guy.
He
looks like a racer.
He looks the exact same.
No, that's a little bit though. When you grow into your features, you look different.
Absolutely. But when I think of Turturro, I think of movies like, or at least in like the like I think probably one of the first movies I remember him with watching him actively in, where I was like, I know that guy, was probably Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
And I think that was a lot of our first experiences to him was a brother. And he was the weird out of the three of them. And that's bizarre because it's not like the other guy that's not George Clooney.
He was
not
weird. The other guy was
also bonkers looking.
The other guy was. Yeah.
It's got three. Tim Blake Nelson is also weird as hell looking. In fact, between the two of them, but in an ugly off, I don't know who would win because they both get first place. Oh, sorry. That's the wrong picture. They both get first place in my heart with that. They're both singularly unattractive men, but that doesn't mean they can't be hot or sexy. It just means they have a type.
We have to remember when it comes to attractiveness, no one is attractive sitting next to George Clooney.
Matt Damon is. Brad Pitt is.
Comparison.
Ocean cast is.
You can be Miss America. You can be Gisele Bündchen. You can be literally the most beautiful person in the world. But if you're next to George Clooney, you're going to be the less attractive of the two.
Wait, Laura Dern is not ugly sexy. Laura Dern is just sexy, but I do get that she has an angularness to her that sort of makes her look manly. She looks manly sexy. Laura Dern's manly sexy. She's got masculine kind of features, but that's different.
I just think she's fucking hot. I think she's gorgeous. Yeah.
Mm. Arnold looked damn sexy. Arnold? You mean his wife? What's her name?
Who?
Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Schwartz?
Arnold? Who? Hey, Arnold? We're talking about William.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
What are you talking about, William?
I mean, Arnold, he's a fine-looking guy.
Mr. Freeze? Oh, you're talking about literally Batman and Robin. I guess. Arnold looked fine in Batman and Robin. That wasn't really what I was paying attention to in Batman and Robin. I was trying to pay attention to the nipples on that bat suit. I was never a big George Clooney stan, though. So when I watch movies like Oh Brother or like a lot of the Coen Brothers stuff, I'm not really watching it for Clooney. I think he does a good job in them. He's perfectly serviceable. And I think he has fun doing them. But like, I'm really watched for like those side characters, for the John Goodman, for the Turturro, for the Macy's, for the Tim Blake Nelsons, for the, you know.
I do think that I feel like we're going to get kind of getting off topic a little bit, but I do think that George Clooney is in a very similar situation as like Brad Pitt, where they're both are trying to be character actors, where they try to play the weird, funny characters, but seeing how attractive they look, I don't want to say it takes away from it, but
I know what your argument is here, and I think there's some validity to it. I mean, I think that Pitt, more so than Clooney, tries to do character work.
Yeah.
Like, when you look at especially like Pitt's earlier work, like in 12 Monkeys, and even stuff like,
Fight Club.
I'm sure I'm like, my mind's looking right now, Fight Club and stuff like that. Like, he's always trying to go for something. I think he goes to a different octave, and I think he like, you know, in Inglourious Basterds and stuff like that. I think he like burrows in on like some part of himself that really is interested in craft acting and like perfecting his craft. Whereas Clooney's like, you know, he started out doing like ER and before that, like a younger, I think, TV for like Canadian television. So he's just like a journeyman. Like he's good at acting and he can pretend to be other people, but he's inherently just kind of always going in and punching a clock and turning in a performance. I mean, I remember him saying after Oh Brother, they're like, he's like, why even bother like doing more films now that the best work of my career is behind me? And like, that's like a pretty interesting statement to make at like 40 as like an actor, to be like, yeah, the rest of it's just gonna be me phoning it in because like this movie already happened.
Yeah, it's like I've heard a lot of actors kind of make very similar statements. Like Russell Crowe, when he completed Les Mis, he mentioned, the thing is, regardless of how you think of his musical performances,
Love him in Les Mis.
I do too. I know a lot of people really, really hate Les Mis, especially his performance in particular. Even though I like him in it,
I loved him in Chevy.
But he's mentioned like in several times after, years after, he's like, he always compares the making of every movie he does after to Les Mis, just because it was such a new, interesting film, like filming process that he never really was able to really challenge himself to do. And
that's really interesting. That's interesting because I spent a lot of my day, just any given day, spent thinking of it. Why did they decide to go that route with Les Mis? Why do the diegetic music where they all had to like sing on the spot?
Because Tumblr is like
I'm just interested in it. But if Russell Crowe liked it, I mean, if I was Russell Crowe, I'd spend all my time feeling bad that my best days were during my literally the first movie I ever did. I'd spend the rest of my time being like, well, nothing's going to be Gladiator, I guess, so fuck it. But it's cute that he chose Les Mis as the thing to look back on, the Halcon days of Les Miserables.
Well, Gladiator in particular, he's mentioned that he didn't feel like he really challenged himself as an actor all that much. He was only for a handful of scenes was he allowed to really be a complete blubbering mess, his words. And there would be points where he's like, okay, how extreme in terms of emotion can I be? And apparently Ridley Scott was like, don't do it too much because we still want guys to love this movie and they don't like seeing guys cry.
We want guys to love this movie. So we're going to make Joaquin Phoenix the most frilliest, franciest, like most fluffiest, like bad guy you've ever seen. He might as well be doing his guy liner through half of that movie. He's going to be our main villain.
Or he does that weird thing with like...
I fell in love with Joaquin Phoenix because of Gladiator. He was, well, that and Quills.
So weird.
So weird. I'd be like, yeah, are you not
entertained? Till this day, I literally know a handful of people that are like, I just don't want to see anything with Joaquin Phoenix. After I saw him in Gladiator.
Oh, really? He has like, didn't want to see Joker because they were too upset about Gladiator.
And I'm like, oh, he's actually supposed to be like a really cool, chill dude, but okay.
I've actually heard that he's very much not a cool, chill dude, but I think before Rooney Mara, at least, he was supposed to be a very creepy kind of dude. But you know, his parents were like in that cult, like the Children of God cult. It seems like a very intense family.
Yeah,
Ellen Barkin, ugly, sexy.
And then his brother Rippy's
been. I know you guys are just naming women with sort of masculine features, I think. I don't think that she's ugly, sexy. I think she's just masculine.
It's a real dick thing to do, to just name women with...
I think I understand what you're saying, because it's like women who have masculine features are men who have feminine features, I think, traditionally in culture. We just assign them as, like, that doesn't look like how, you know, doesn't go along and doesn't form along the gender binary. So I understand how society, like, just like we like symmetrical features and Anglo-Saxon features, and it's just a thing that culture has bred into us, and we're trying to be woke and recognize our systematic issues with it. Mm-hmm. I think we can like, admit that, like, no, that person's like not ugly or even unattractive. That person just has features that we've traditionally assigned to be the opposite gender.
It changes so much as well what's considered attractive and what isn't. Like, thin lips were like the thing until like maybe 15 years ago. The thing is, like, also like body shapes and everything. I mean, like, literally, there were like ads. for like in the 1920s to like the 1950s, there were literally ads in newspapers being like, you want to get your man, or you want to get that guy across the street to like hit on you, you have to get like a weight loss pill. You have to get, sorry, not weight loss, you have to get a weight gain pill in order to have a little extra meat on your bones that he'll be, so he'll be interested, because no one likes a skinny bitch.
I mean, we do have like a plus size, like plus size beauty campaign. And I mean, we don't need to get into it, but this is very much like that Office episode where Hillary Swank. What we've decided is culture is attractive and unattractive changes. I don't think 20 years ago we would consider people like Ronda Rousey or like, you know, like any of these MMA fighters or like, you know, to be attractive women. And now we do. Now people find them just really hot, and people like women who have really toned bodies and really buff bodies. So I think that their culture is changing. Now, here's an interesting one that ties back to what we were talking about originally. Jodie Foster. She was playing such like ingenues back in the day, very, very young age, because of Taxi Driver, put in this position. I was thinking that watching this movie, perhaps like Jodie Foster's whole deal, her whole thing about being very, very private about her, you know, private life and who she's with and stuff. She's never openly come out and identified as being gay or bisexual or even straight. She's never identified as anything. She has
like one or two adopted children.
Yeah, but she's like, her whole thing has been like, it's none of your fucking business, and it never was. Absolutely. And like, you know, and that's her right to say, but it's also always struck me as this very like intense vibe to have about things. Like, we are living in a culture where like you can be out and proud and like it really isn't that big of a deal. And as a celebrity, like, you know, you can be a role model for other people. I wonder if it is because she was pushed into these kind of roles at a very early age, where she was always supposed to be the wilting, like, ingenue. She was supposed to be the hooker and the young girl hooker, and now, like, the young girl rape victim twice over who, like, just goes to other guys, you know, and tries to get help that way. If she was just kind of forced into these, you know, kind of gender constructs that really left her being like, I don't fucking have to answer to any of you. Like, fuck you guys.
Well, she's definitely in this very, very small circle of not only successful child actors, but that grew into their adult careers, obviously, but very successful child actors that grew into her adult career and continued that legacy quite a bit. And they, not only as an actor, but also as a director with an expanding their,
and as a woman specifically, a child actor who was like, known for her like sexiness as like a prepubescent child, who then got to grow up into like an adult who gets to be an androgynous character in every single role she's in. Like, every role of Jodie Foster's is androgynous. It could be played by a man as it could be played by a woman. Try it. Try thinking of a Jodie Foster role that wouldn't be able to be played by a man.
Like, yeah, Hotel Artemis, Nell.
I mean, not Nell. I'm saying like post Nell. I'm talking like post.
I do think Nell actually could be and go either way, but.
But I mean, like more like you know, like Inside Man or Elysium, or like she only picks roles of like non-gendered, like, you know, structured characters.
Carnage can really go either way. Doesn't really matter all that much.
I think the last one I can remember is not Red Eye. What's the one where she was on a flight? She was like
Flight Plan.
Flight Plan is maybe the last one I can think of. Oh, and Beaver, but she directed that. So.
I like Beaver.
But I think that's really cool. Like, she's definitely taken autonomy back on her career and been like, I don't want to be that anymore. So now I'm only going to be this kind of thing. And you can also say it's because she's a woman of a certain age now that the roles are just inherently less gendered. But she's, it's kind of cool that she gets these roles now that she's like, no, I'm going to be the CEO. Or like, no, I'm going to be like the Secretary of Defense. Or like, no, I'm going to be like the President. Or no, I'm going to like, whatever role she takes, she just gets to be like written for like a non-binary kind of character.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's almost, or they almost come off as asexual, I guess, where relation, like their personal relationships, romantic relationships is not even on the table at all.
It's not even part of the character. So it's like,
conversation.
Which, by the way, we would consider that just normal if it was a dude character. Like, we'd be like, of course, like, we don't need to know about like his girlfriend. We don't need to know about like him crying in an office in Alone at Night. Like, I think of her character on Inside Man and I'm just like, that's such a well-written like fixer character that didn't need to be a woman. It could have easily been played by a dude. It's just a fixer. Like, that's what they do. They come in and they fix the problem, and they're not a good guy and they're not a bad guy. They're just here to sort of facilitate the sort of conversation between the good guy and bad guy. yeah. and they like represent the bad guy, but they themselves are not inherently bad. Like, I don't know. I really like that character. I watched Elysium last night. I don't know why that movie was so bad and so long and had like 20 MacGuffins, but her character in that was also really interesting in that like they just kind of like existed in a non-gendered sphere where like they didn't seem to be considered a woman or a dude.
It's yeah, that's that movie in particular. That movie is a really it's a weird one. That's a really weird one.
You know what's so sucky about Elysium is how close that seems to a biopic or like a documentary right now. Because I was like, oh yeah, well, you know, when all the rich people get to go to space and have all their health care problems taken care of and all the poor people have to live here on Earth. Yeah. I'm just going to end up being true and I'm going to be like, damn it, it should have been Chappie.
Oh, the potential. What could have been? I think Susan Sarandon actually would have taken, is that in that role in particular for Chappie? Anyway. He's in Chappie. She's in Chappie, I think. I'm thinking of Sigourney Weaver. Yeah, forget me. I'm mixing up my redheads. Yeah, so tying it back to this movie, though, in particular, though, she's definitely known to play characters that really play into these victims, essentially, where they are asking for help the entire time, whether it be they're asking for help or they desperately need help and they don't realize it yet. Taxi Driver. I was like, ah, crap, there's like a few other movies and I just am having a complete brain fart on it. But it's really kind of funky in particular, just because we also see her in The Accused just a few years later, where she plays a rape survivor. And so that's also supposed to be a period film. And then there's this that's just like not even 5 years earlier, and where she is a survivor of an attempted rape. And it's
wait, really? Like, oh, I didn't even realize that. Oh, wow.
Yeah, in this movie, she's it's like mentioned a bunch of times. He went to jail for attempted rape.
Oh, in this movie, sorry, I thought you meant The Accused, yeah. And I was like, oh.
No, in The Accused, yeah, it was like a gang rape, horrible situation.
God,
she survives, and she goes through the trial. It's a whole thing. But it's kind of a like a I feel like that'd be a really terrifying and horrible double feature based on that theme.
It's also of like not
her
my
in a role of rape, I mean, rape victim.
Thankfully, head. I will say this about John Patrick Kelly. When we read the plot description of this movie, we're both like, oh, are we sure we want to tackle this? Because this like seems like dicey subjects. Like it's dicey subjects that were tackled in the 70s. So we don't even know like how well they would have translated till like to today and how we think about stuff today. I gotta say, like, give it up for John Patrick Shanley. This was his first movie that he ever wrote. This was his debut feature. I thought it was like handled pretty well. And I feel like the movie synopsis overemphasizes the part about the attempted rape, and that like is not actually the hugest part of this movie. Of course, it's like a part of it. Yeah. And of course, him stalking her is a part of it, but it's almost like an American Graffiti kind of story. It's about like all of them. It's about like the collective group of which him stalking her is like, and it's not even like quite stalking, honestly. Like he calls her up and tells her to come somewhere and she shows up. Is that stalking? Like that's not, he doesn't follow her around anywhere.
He does kidnap her.
He does kidnap her, but that's not.
He stalks her and kidnaps her and
but
takes
stalking
her.
Stalking means like following her around without her knowledge. He called her up and asked her to come someplace and she went there.
That's true.
That's just like straight kidnapping.
That's true, but he does kidnap her. And he is actively searching for her the entire time. He is clearly obsessed with her. He has this like odd fixation of her. And I think that really kind of comes from his relationship with his mom. Because this is I really want to go back to that scene because it's such a weird scene in particular, because I don't know if his mom has any kind of like particular mental illness or his mom is completely disassociated or if she also like physically, mentally I don't know if sexually abused him. I just don't know.
I feel like she was abused herself. Dynamic. That this kind of vibe I got, that she was abused and she went into some sort of fugue state. Like, she's just like out to lunch and she's like, that's why I keep saying like, wake up, like you got to wake up. He's almost like, she's like, she's whatever her illness is, feels like it was like the result of trauma.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's some kind of horrible trauma, and he can't get her to wake up from it. And unfortunately,
then his response is to what, Alex?
Well, he ends up killing her after she does have a slight moment of realization, and he's like, "Thank you," and then he shoves her out the window.
Then he shoves her goddamn ass out a window, and you're like, "Whoa!"
Literally right out the window.
That was a song me and my parents like growing up. It was like, throw her out the window. I don't know.
Is that a real song?
Yeah, no. It is. Yeah, it was a real song it was like a Dr. Demento song, though. So it was like a novelty song. But it was went throw her out the window.
I refuse to believe that. That does not sound real. No.
What do you think of Robbins in this?
I think Robbins in this movie, I think he's weird. Okay, when was like Bill Durnham? When did that movie come out?
You mean like when was his and Susan Sarandon's like beginning of their thing? What was Shawshank? Shawshank was later.
Shawshank was like 94.
I was saying when was Shawshank, but you're right. Shawshank was a lot later. So I think Bull
Durham. It wasn't that much later. It was only 5 years, I think, Bull in between
was
this movie.
88. Or, he was in stuff earlier than that, though. I feel like. What am I trying to think of?
Wait, hold up.
Well, maybe not. Maybe this was kind of like his beginning. Yeah, he was beginning in The Player. No, that was 90s. Let's say career.
Bill Durham, that was 87, 88.
It was 88, yeah. He was in 82. He was in three episodes of Staying Elsewhere playing a terrorist. So him and Denzel.
He was in Howard the Duck.
That's right. He was in Howard the Duck. But Bill Durham was the breakout role. You were right. Bill Durham was his big breakout. That was his movie role. That was his big thing. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. That's correct. You win the prize. I guess,
give me a vote, guys. Just put me a shout.
The one I was thinking was the movie earlier was Bob Roberts. The technically, it's an SNL movie, Bob Roberts, but it's that was 92. So, no, it was Bill Durham was his big one. So, what year was this movie?
This was 87. Bill Durham was 88. Okay, so
this five was points. Before, this was this his first film role?
No, it was not his first film.
He was in Toy Soldiers. Okay. This was he was in Howard the Duck. He was in Top Gun.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, did anyone know that? Did anyone know Tim
Robbins?
Yeah,
it was actually a Schmodown question.
I think I remember that now, but that's, or it was like phrased differently. It was like, what movie has Tim Robbins and this person, and like,
yeah.
Wasn't it really hard to get because no one thinks of him in Top Gun?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Kelly McGinnis, Tim Robbins, and Anthony Edwards.
Wait. This movie was the same year. You're saying that this movie was 88. So is this movie, Bull Durham, and Tapeheads. Oh, my God, Tapeheads. That one was really funny. That one had, I believe, Adam Sandler. And no, that was another one. This one was him and this other dude. Oh, John Cusack. That's right. The John Cusack, Tim Robbins one. What's one I'm thinking of where he has really long hair? Oh, Jacob's Ladder was 90. I'd forgotten about his repertoire, but Tim Robbins has a very interesting career.
Miss Firecracker.
What's Firecracker?
Miss Firecracker.
What's that?
It stars Holly Hunter, Mary Steenburgen, where they were like cousins, Alfred Woodard. And it's essentially about this. Actually, I feel like you actually kind of like it. And it's about set in the deep South, like in Louisiana or something, where Holly Hunter, she plays essentially this small town trailer trash girl that is trying to get into a local beauty pageant. And no one wants her to do it, but she wants to do it. And in the beauty pageant to be Miss Firecracker for the local state beauty thing. And everyone is like completely, and she's like, she's been training, she's been challenging herself for like 5 years to like develop this talent to do it. And it's heartbreaking. It's hard to watch. And her cousin, Mary Steenburgen, she's kind of manipulative. She's her cousin that's won like 3 times before. She's like more like traditionally pretty. She's tall, she's wealthy, and but yeah, and it's kind of a weird thing. And Holly Hunter's character, like I said, she's a trailer trash, like she's played, yeah, but she like works at like a local bar and like a welder.
Sounds like an interesting movie. I don't want to interrupt for 1 second. I don't mean to do that, but like I just saw, like, I looked at my phone for 2 seconds. I saw that Bob Odenkirk has like collapsed on the set of Better Call Saul and is like being rushed to a hospital. So like, thoughts and prayers for Bob Odenkirk, yo. Like, that's a truly upsetting one to like hear about in the middle of the show. Man, please God, don't let anything bad happen to Bob Odenkirk. He's the best. We couldn't stand to lose that treasure. Yikes. But that actually, that movie sounds like it is kind of right up my alley, although it also sounds like a melodrama. Gotta be honest. Is it a comedy?
I definitely think it's more of a dramedy. It's definitely funny in parts, sad in parts. I would definitely call it a melodrama dramedy. It's technically on IMDb's labeled exclusively as comedy, but I call bullshit on that. But it's available on HBO Max.
Okay, I'll check it out. I feel like a lot of good things are available on HBO Max these days.
Yeah.
It's like I watched Disturbia last night on HBO Max, and I was like, this movie is very much trying to be Rear Window, but also very much a straightforward narrative. Like, I was like, I've never seen a movie that is just, you think it's one thing, and then it just continues to be that one thing, and it doesn't deviate. So I don't think it could technically even be called like a thriller. Like, is it that thrilling if you know exactly what the bad guy is and what's going on? I don't know.
Knives Out.
No, that movie you're not supposed to, or you know who did it, but you're not supposed to know like how it got done or the machinations. Like Disturbia, they're like, I think David Morse killed some people, and you're like, yep, he did. Good
just
job. Like-
Just that's exactly like Knives Out. You know who killed her.
No, but I'm saying there was the part about Chris Evans. You didn't know, like, because, like, yes, he physically killed himself, but, like, she didn't actually poison him and blah, 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 blah. Like, the thing that Chris Evans set up in motion, he's the puppet master behind it all. This movie didn't have any puppet master. Like, the reveal of Knives Out still counts as a reveal because you're not supposed to know that he was bad. And in this movie, you know immediately that David Morse is bad. And I thought the reveal was going to be that the girlfriend's parents were bad because they mentioned how the dad's done something shady and they had to move. And I was like, oh, that's going to be a fun twist. But no, there wasn't a twist. It just, David Morse did it. He killed all the people. Good job, Shia. You did it.
I like the movie a little bit, to be honest. I don't love it, but I definitely appreciate it for
what it is. Is it like Rear Window? I've never seen Rear Window. Is that what happens in Rear Window? He just thinks the guy did it, and the guy did it. The end.
Wait, hold up. You've never seen Rear Window?
No. I mean, I know it's about. I know it's about a guy who catches a neighbor doing something. I guess those movies, yeah, the tension doesn't come from not knowing who did it.
The tension
comes from, like, knowing the guy's being gaslit into thinking he didn't.
Oh, I am so envious of you right now. I'm so jealous. Okay. After Pokemon, the first movie. After Pokemon for the first movie, we're diving into Rear Window.
What city does that take place in? That has to be New York, right? Because there's windows and they're close enough to each other.
It's Hitchcock.
Wait, we just got to San Francisco for Vertigo. Like, that's not a guaranteed thing. Like, Psycho takes place.
I associate with Hitchcock with, well, that and Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly. To me, it's like, it's such a New York City movie in particular.
Yeah, everyone's saying Rear Window episode. Okay, guys, I guess I should admit that I've like seen most of Hitchcock, but not all of Hitchcock. But I know the plot of all of Hitchcock, so don't worry about it. I know what city they play in.
All the awards.
Don't even try to play me in Schmodown against Hitchcock. I'll beat your ass, but I just haven't seen it all necessarily.
I can't wait to dive into that. I can't wait to dive into that movie with you after we cover Pokemon the first
Hitchcock.
Movie.
I think Hitchcock, to me, he's like a slow burn, and like I like that. I always really liked as a kid. I liked Alfred Hitchcock Presents because I love that idea of the anthology thing that everything was confined within an hour, and I like that the same level way I like the Twilight Zone, but sometimes even more than Twilight Zone because he was always about just like turning that screw, and it wasn't supernatural or just about like nom nom nom. How delicious is this plot? Like, is this like little. Like, I love Rope. Like, I think Rope is a perfect movie, although it's very hard for me to watch because I don't like the tension of it. But, like, God, the shots are amazing. And, God, like, what a perfect little model film that is of just people locked in a room dealing with some shit. with a body just inside of a trunk of luggage or whatever. Or not trunk. It's like, isn't it a valise?
Like in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
No, I'm thinking of Rope. I'm thinking of the movie Rope, not Trains, Planes, and Automobiles.
Do you not remember when we had that episode? And yeah. That was like one of the fan theories.
That what?
In the trunk was actually his wife's dead body.
Oh my god, I forgot with Roka. Oh my god, I did forget that. That was our fan theory.
That was like fan theory. That was like one. That was the biggest fan theory that I found. That was like that was like most one of the most popular one.
This is I'll get my coat.
That was the reason why it was so heavy and he couldn't leave it behind.
Oh, that's right. Maybe his wife was in the trunk. Was that our theory?
And he would always talk about how he couldn't leave her.
Oh my god. I've only had the vaguest recollection of that conversation happening, but that's hilarious if that's true.
Yeah.
Alex, I do want to say that, like, where would you put this in the John Patrick, like, you know, what would you call it? The John Patrick timeline? The Stanley spectrum?
Yeah, I would definitely put it towards the bottom, to be honest. Mostly just because it is definitely a 48 hours in the life kind of situation. But also, I was very bored watching it. I was also very angry as well with the casual use of sexual violence.
Which is implied. We hear about it and we don't see any of it.
Yeah, no, a lot of like, you're right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot implied sexual violence.
Yeah.
Including like date rape, how she was almost raped, and then she's about to potentially be raped.
Casually she treats it.
Yeah. It's just like it's a very casual thing. I mean, like the girls were sold for $5, and I know it's not a sexual thing, but it feels
it was definitely sexual. Mm-hmm.
It was yeah. And he's not being like, oh, take these hookers out for $5. It was just more like, I just need to get these two girls out of my car. And so he didn't have that in mind, but he had that focus of this like this feeling of transaction against these two women. So I mean, you're right. It's not so much like a intense sexual violence, but there's a lot of sexual insinuations, insinuations regarding potential sexual violence.
Yeah.
And that just like in the casual conversation surrounding it, it really kind of made me uncomfortable, but I think that's the point of the movie, honestly.
Yeah, I think this movie kind of suffers a little bit from like the time I think it was probably made. I mean, it's a little bit late to be so much like entrenched in the world of Scorsese and that kind of stuff. It actually is kind of late for Jodie Foster to be seeming that young. 88. It's like a long, long time away from Taxi Driver, right? That was in the 75s, right? Like Taxi Driver.
Like, but I think it was 78.
Okay, 78. So she looks like she's very, very young in this. Like, I would put her in, like, early 20s. I guess she was very young in Taxi Driver. So, like, maybe, yeah. So she's, like, 20, 23 in this, I guess. If this is 88 and the other one was 78, sure. Okay,
well,
so
like, she's 23. That's fine. Like, regardless of whether or not she's a child, I mean, she could be 23.
No, that makes sense. That actually, I was just saying, though, for my own sanity in terms of, like, how the world works. I was like, how is Jodie Foster that young in 88? But I, like, of course, she's that young in 88. She was very, very young when she was in Taxi Driver. So, like, it makes sense. That tracks. But this still feels like a very early Jodie Foster role. And I feel like this movie feels like it takes place in the 70s. This didn't feel like an almost 1990 movie. It feels very much like it's in the John Cassavetes, American Graffiti. Like, this feels very much like a mid-70s kind of movie. And it's actually really surprising to find out that it's so late in the game. Because it does kind of... You know, it takes place in the 50s, but it looks like it was made in the 70s, not the 80s. And I feel like it kind of has that 70s vibe where everyone kind of talks and you're like, are they just making up the dialogue on the spot? Was this like improvised?
It kind of feels like an improv, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of feels like a Cassavetes movie in that way, like Women Under the Influence or something, where you're like, is everyone just having conversations over each other, like in like Rosemary's Baby or something, where it's just sort of like the natural verite style of movies. But I guess this was just another, first of all, it was another director. It wasn't Stanley directing it. I thought the story at parts had like the Moonstruck vibe, where like even the way Turturro was talking in it, I was like, this almost sounds like twisted a little bit, and it would just be Nick Cage and Moonstruck, because he has very romantic ideals of like what he's doing, he doesn't think he's the bad guy, but he has a very like romantic ideal for the relationship. And it can kind of sound, when he's telling his mom to snap out of it, it sounds a lot like her telling Nick Cage to snap out of it. And like, and when you think about like the way that Nick Cage treats the romance in that movie and how he just kind of grabs her and decides that he's going to kiss her now. And, you know, like it's not that different of a dynamic. It's just sort of like how you view it and like how comfortable the woman is.
Yeah, that I absolutely agree with you. Something that also I feel like it's kind of that I've noticed in a few of his movies is the whole like bodega environment, the bodega scene,
I guess that's New York.
Yeah, there's always a bodega scene, or like there's one of those little grocer specialty grocers kind of thing, and the guys were like in there with the bakery, or they were selling salamis or something, and she was like giving out fish or something at one point. I don't know if it was a pet store or a bodega, I don't know what it was. But it was,
It's like bodegas. Like it's like what we have in New York. It's just like a place to congregate. So it's just sort of like where you go, what you do. It's like you become really good friends. It's like in LA, I guess it would be like your local coffee shop or something. It's just like where everyone always is. So like you get this little slice of life as people are moving and doing stuff, but then you also can just run into, it's like there's a lot of happenstance like stuff. It's a really good place to set scenes. Like, so I Do the Right Thing is so often like set in that, in the pizza joint, which is like, you know, just kind of like the hub, or it's like set on the corner, because there's a bodega in every corner of New York City. There's not like one corner of New York, unless it's literally like a hotel, that isn't just like a Korean grocery store or like a place with like a cat and like some like really old bag of chips.
Which I'm actually really jealous about, just because like growing up in the Midwest,
you actually drive places.
Yeah, we never had anything like that would be comparable to a bodega like experience.
It's 4 a.m. You want a tuna sandwich, you go out and walk down the street, and literally half a block away you can get yourself a 4 a.m. tuna sandwich.
It's awesome. I mean, like, or even like the coffee shops or anything. Like, I grew up on military bases, there wasn't a Starbucks within walking distance, or unless I wanted to drive 15 or 20 minutes. That, I mean, like, even when I moved off base, we didn't have we didn't have Starbucks or anything around, unless I was around the college campus. But we the idea of the bodega is something, and that just kind of environment is something I'm very jealous about.
It's a cool culture. It's funny because when I first, like, there was a place I moved to in Brooklyn that was like not really around that many other places. Like, it was kind of underneath the highway of the BQE of the Brooklyn Queens Expressway. And there wasn't like a bodega like in walking distance. And I remember what there was like they opened up a gas station, like a big, you know, right off the highway, like trucker gas station right next to my house. So at 4 a.m. I'd go in there and get a tuna sandwich. And those were like way worse because they weren't like made fresh. Those were like gross ass, like 7-Eleven tuna sandwiches. And I remember I used to fall asleep with my little, I had another little doggy with me, and I used to fall asleep with like a half-eaten tuna or chicken salad in my hand. I'd wake up and it was like not there anymore because the little doggy had eaten it. Anyway, but guys, I think this, we've kind of gotten off track here. We've had some fun though. We're getting to the end of our John Patrick Shanley stunts, and then we have to figure out what we're doing next. If anyone has any ideas for actors, but I think specifically we'd like the idea of the screenwriter, like going with another screenwriter and just going full helm on their stuff. So if anyone has any ideas, give us a holler and let us know what you guys are thinking. Because you know what else I realized, Alex? Congo doesn't have a love story. It might be the one action adventure movie, like in that genre of like high action adventure, that does not have any romantic subplot. Like there's not one
character
that has like a subplot.
Doubt?
Well, no, but that's a different kind of movie. I'm saying like a adventure like movie. Like try to think of another action adventure kind of like a swashbuckling film that doesn't have a romantic subplot in it. And like it's really hard to find one.
Predator.
Well, that's not action adventure. That's like action horror thriller. I'm talking about Indiana Jones, National Treasure, like the ones where they're jet setting around the world and like, you know, fencing. It's like really hard.
I also think that's just more of a, like, because I have a horrible knowledge of adventure movies.
That's true. It's hard to put in the category, but like
Fallen franchise. What about the Angel Has Fallen franchise?
I think of those as more like action thriller. I'm talking about like action adventure, which is like Jungle
Geostorm.
Cruise. The that's action thriller again. Like the movies that are like serious threats as opposed to movies where the tone is sort of like buoyant John Williams kind of score, you know, or like movies where like Kurt Russell's in it as the main dude. What falls under the technically the swashbuckling category in IG? Those are the movies I'm talking about. Like Jurassic Park. Like even Jurassic Park doesn't really have that much of a romantic thing in it, but it still has this sort of, you know, I guess actually Jurassic Park is a rare movie that even though there is a romantic couple in there, like they are not the focus and their relationship is not like remotely sexual.
Let's see.
North by Northwest. Now, but there is a femme fatale in that. It's a little different.
Well, but that doesn't, like, just because there's a femme fatale doesn't mean that there is a...
You're right. No, you're right. So maybe it was just Hitchcock. It was, that's what I was looking for all along.
Ooh. No. I don't know.
Treasure Island? Is there a love interest in Treasure Island?
I don't think so.
Okay, maybe Treasure Island counts.
Well, I'm like, Killian, I'm getting like Moon and the Iron Man, Zorro, and I'm like, they're all...
By definition, I think a lot of these have to have a love interest in order for them to be, like, viable. Rocketeer has a love interest in it. There's
100% a love interest
in it. Oh, no. He's just saying these are the movies that fall into the category.
Tarzan and Jane, are you kidding me?
No, he's saying these are the movies that fall into the category of swashbuckling in IG. Rocketeer, Indiana Jones...
Oh, no, Legend of Tarzan is not considered IG. It's not IG swashbuckling film.
He's saying it is IG. Muppet's Treasure Island. The superior version. Romancing the Bone. That is my definition.
Of Treasure Island. I love that movie. Muppet Treasure Island.
We have Cabin Fever and We Are All Going Mad. That's also a Tim Curry movie.
And the
anyway.
Big Blue Wet Thing.
Love it. Maybe The Da Vinci Code is maybe one that doesn't have that much, but there's still a romance. It's just not that big of a deal. Anyway,
In the first one, there is no romance, like not even a wisp of a romance.
Yeah, I think that would be the closest one is like thing. So, guys, for next week, what we are doing is we are wrapping this up. So we have January Man up for next week, and then we are going to end on a high note, or not a high note, a strong note. We are ending with the one that I didn't even know he did this one. The 1993 movie about the true story about the Uruguay rugby team that gets flown into a mountain and have to eat themselves. I think that's what the movie, it's called Alive. Guys, you know this movie exists. I didn't know it was John Patrick Shanley. It's going to be such a strong note to end this whole Michigas around.
Mm-hmm.
Can you do all Tim Curry movies? God, please.
Tim Curry has one of those magical careers where he's been in a bazillion things. Yeah, I can't
change the name of the show.
I have to pull my head right now.
We'll have to change the name of the show to like add some Curry to it, or like you know,
you and Curry.
We'll have to like come up with a terrible pun for a Curry themed pun if we change this to a Tim Curry based show. But Alex, where can we find you?
You can find me right here. At @real_AlexMack. I will not address that horrible movie. I'm not going to go into that. I'm not going to know. How many pedos?
Don't get baited, Alex.
I'm not going to do it. But you can find me there on @real_AlexMack on Twitter. And I just do regular updates on how close I'm getting to my trying to get to my 300 brand new movie watches for the year.
Yeah,
I'm trying to watch 300 first time watches. Right now I'm close to 150, so halfway there, and yeah, so wish me luck.
I wish you all the best, Alex, with that. What's been some highlights recently?
Recently I watched a handful of like 80s thrillers. I loved Willard.
Willard is great. Oh my God! Wait, the one with
I can't remember his name, but I was like, isn't that the guy from X-Men? And I was like,
wait, which one is it? Is it
the first X-Men? Like 2001 2001 X-Men, he plays like the senator that's against all mutants.
Isn't that Tracy Letts again? No, it's a oh my God! Now I'm going crazy. Willard has the guy that looks like Tracy Letts in it.
I saw Nightmare on Elm Street.
It was Crispin Glover. It's the dad from Back to the Future.
Oh, no, not Crispin Glover is in the remake. I'm talking about the original, like, 70s version.
Oh, Bruce Davidson. Yes, it is the guy that looks like Tracy Letts. It is the guy that looks like Tracy Letts. Mm-hmm. He looks just like the guy who wrote August Osage County, just mm-hmm. by the way.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, way to call it.
Did see Nightmare on Elm Street, the first one. Mm-hmm. Up until recently, I only saw the first one. I watched Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
Well, of course, classic watch along.
I was like, you know what? Gotta mix it up. Gotta get some sci-fi movies in there, you know? I watched The Man Who Fell to Earth because I wanted some Bowie action in my life.
Nice. My dad would love you.
Mm-hmm. Monkey Shines.
Oh my god, the Stephen King story? Monkey Shines?
Is it a kid's Stephen King story?
The one with the clapping monkey?
Like,
with the symbols? That's the Stephen King short.
Yeah, I mean, like, about a quadriplegic man.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I believe that's a Stephen King story. Am I crazy? Mm-hmm. We need Adam Collins here again. It was a Romero film. Directed by... Maybe not. Maybe I'm crazy. No, yeah, it was a British novel. Never mind. I'm fucking mm-hmm. nuts.
Phil's kind of like... It was kind of funny because watching it, I was like... I don't understand anyone's motivation in this movie.
Maybe that's why it seems like a Stephen King movie. Maybe because it kind of follows the beats of a Stephen King movie where, like, here's an evil thing and it does a thing and, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm excited for you. Would you ever consider doing watch-alongs, like, so we can actually watch movies with you?
Yeah, totally. I'd be down for that.
Sweet. As for me, you can find me at all these things. Oh my god, did I have the wrong layout this whole time? No, you put it up right. Great. Mm-hmm. So this Thursday, I'm actually not doing another Video Chronic quiz because I am going to be on Rachel Silvestrini's Music and Mayhem. So that's going to be fun. Check me out there. On Sunday night, I am doing Live in the Dark with rescheduled Mike Mitchell from the Tomorrow War and Doughboys. He's a friend of mine. He's going to be on the show. So we're going to have a good time. I started a new show with Adam Collins last weekend. It's going to be bi-monthly. It's called Why Are We Like This? It's on Saturdays at 7, or every other Saturday at 7. Last week, we spent the entire time talking about this movie Tornado! ! With Bruce Campbell and Ernie Hudson, based on our love of Congo. It was one of Adam's favorite movies growing up, because apparently Adam, as a child on the schoolyard, used to go around unsolicited and going, my three favorite movies are Mortal Kombat, Congo, and Twister. And, like, just tell people that on the schoolyard. And I think that's the cutest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. Like, that just makes my heart, like, beat so much more fondly for Adam. Just knowing, imagine a little Collins on the playground being like, hello, my name's Adam Collins. Like, what do you do? Like, my parents do this. And I have three favorite movies, and they are Mortal Kombat, Twister, and Congo. So cute.
You know what? I absolutely agree, because I think that I would totally be friends with Adam Collins based on
Can I be honest? He should just change that to his Schmodown intro. Like, I'm the coyote. My three favorite movies are Mortal Kombat, Twister, and Congo. And I would just be like, yes, there's the character. That's all we need. That's the whole thing. That's the tweet.
Okay. If for you, okay, like, before I pass it over to you, what would be, like, your, I'm Drew Grant. I'm Video Drew. And these
are my That's a great question. It depends on what age, but I probably at a very young
child,
age.
Children's version of you.
Yeah, it would be like, okay, my name is Sarah, because that was my name back then. I love Jurassic Park, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Willow. That'd probably be my three.
I'm into that.
I was a very cool kid who was not given enough boundaries.
I would have said Muppet Treasure Island, Fantasia, like the 40s Fantasia, and probably Sword in the Stone.
I mean, I think my choices I just chose off the cuff, but the more I think about it, the more I'm like, those would absolutely be my choices. I love maybe Clue. I loved Rocky Horror Picture Show, and I loved Clue. I really did have a Tim Curry thing. But I also love Jurassic Park so much, and I wanted to name my daughter Sorsha because I didn't realize I could just change my name if I felt like doing something like that. So I was like, I'm going to name my kid Sorsha, like in from Willow.
Are you Scottish?
No, I just liked the name from Willow because I thought she was a cool character because she was like badass and like had a sword. And I liked her flirtation with Val Kilmer because that was a swashbuckling adventure movie. So, of course, their thing was like the center stage. And it was hot. It was very, very hot. I also really loved Indiana Jones at a certain point in my life. I went through a whole Harrison Ford thing and like the Star Wars bit.
I mean,
so I don't know what age caught me, but like early on it was Rocky Horror Picture Show. It was Willow and it was Clue or what was the third one I said? Or the third one. Or whatever the third thing I said. Or Jurassic Park. I loved it. Fantasia when you were a kid, right? So Marcus just knows you so well. Okay, guys, this has another been an episode of Cinema Bias. Thank you for joining us. I'm Video Drew. That is Alex Mack. We will see you next time for talking about January Man, whatever that is. Okay, bye, guys.